The Fantasy Animation Podcast is a completely independent production. It is made by experts in the field. Chris is a lecturer in liberal arts and visual cultures education at King's College London and author of The Computer Animated Film, available in all good bookshops. And I, Alex that is, am a senior lecturer in film and media studies at the University of Portsmouth and author of Encountering the Impossible, The Fantastic in Hollywood Fantasy Cinema, available in even better bookshops. We do this podcast to provide audiences with an informative and hopefully entertaining guide through the ways in which you can not only enjoy fantasy and animation, but study it, examine it, explore it, and of course, make it and have a career in it. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of the Fantasy Animation Podcast with me, Chris Holliday.
And me, Alex Sargent.
If we sound a little different, it's because we are recording this live. This is one of several we are recording at the BAFS 2024 academic conference. So we've managed to grab, metaphorically, a few academics to come and talk with us about various films that we thought would be really interesting. So if for this episode and a few others, I guess, in the way that we release them, they sound like we're not in our usual space, that's the reason why.
Yeah, we're in an empty seminar room on the University of Sussex campus. Thanks to the BAFS for organising it and allowing us to do all these here. It's nice to be able to meet up with lots of different academics in this one space.
Yes, so we are, for this episode, we are doing, in all true, I was going to say, in the spirit of doing a franchise properly, we're doing the last and the final instalment of the Indiana Jones franchise, so Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. It won't surprise anybody, Alex included, to know that I haven't really seen these films, and I have now seen them, but I also saw them in the wrong order. I was saying to our special guest, kind of before we started, that my first go at Indiana Jones was Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which I saw at cinemas, and then have just watched them in a very disorderly fashion. I have, as of a couple of days ago, now seen Dial of Destiny, so I'm really interested, of course, to talk about digital de-aging. I guess the kind of reflexivity with time. I guess the fact this is, as I mentioned at the start, a sort of franchise film. So, yeah, I think, and also I think there's something to say about this film as maybe a reflection on the issue of de-aging, and maybe that split between sound and an image and the voice. But I think so. That's where I'm coming from, Alex.
Well, I'm glad that we have a guest who will introduce in a second to help us through this, because I'm also not necessarily your classic indie fan.
Interesting. I'll put you down as one. Yeah.
Yeah, I have seen them all, and I saw them all as a kid, but I never was sort of that into them. My favourite was always Temple of Doom, which is the kind of the weird one.
The middle one,
the horrific one, the racist one. Add whichever synonym you would like.
Sure.
But I always, what was always fascinating about that movie was its kind of fantastical elements. So we can talk about the franchise that we've sort of precursed before we started recording, but you know, as historical drama versus as fantastical drama, as religious epic, and the way it kind of is riffing on all those things. So yeah, no, excited to talk about Dial of Destiny.
Great stuff. We are delighted to be joined by, I think, a scholar who we've mentioned certainly on this podcast many times before, Sarah Thomas, who is Senior Lecturer in Communication and Media at the University of Liverpool, specialising in research on the Hollywood film industry, stardom and immersive media. Her publications include the forthcoming Stars and Franchises, so we can definitely kind of use that, I think, as a starting point, as well as books on James Mason for the BFI Film Stars series, so Bloomsbury 2018, and an article that I've certainly cited on more than one occasion, The Star in VR from Celebrity Studies from 2019. So, Sarah, thank you ever so much for joining us on the pod.
Thanks for having me here. I'm really looking forward to talking about Indiana Jones, because I am a big fan of Indiana Jones.
Well, let's start there. Let's start there. So is this, you're a fan of the franchise. where, how does this fit in with your kind of research into Stardom franchises technology?
It's really interesting to talk about Dial of Destiny specifically, although I'm sure we will talk about all of them because you can't shut me up about the rest of them as well and kind of how they all fit together. There's kind of three modes, I think, in terms of how Indiana Jones as a whole and Dial of Destiny kind of fits into my work. The first is I'm really interested in the intersection between the franchise property, particularly the film franchise series, and how Major Stardom fits into that. Is it a moment of tension that exists between a kind of a character or a storyverse IP, and how does, you know, leading kind of star figures like Harrison Ford fit into that, and how do they work together? So I've completed a chapter actually mapping the kind of the history of Harrison Ford in Indiana Jones as there's an idea of how the shifting star power has affected the franchise series as a whole from 1981 right to the end. And that's going to be in a forthcoming book on the Indiana Jones franchise with Manchester University Press, edited by Luella Chapman. So that's it. That started me then thinking about how stars and franchises work together, which has led to an edited collection that we're working on at the moment and other work that I've done on Keanu Reeves and John Wick. The second mode is my existing work at the moment. What I'm really interested in is the digital replication of celebrity and stardom. So Dial of Destiny, particularly, I was kind of thrilled when all the early kind of discourse came out about the de-aged Harrison Ford and the kind of the spectacle of what that would be. So it really kind of fits in with what I'm kind of interested in how digital technologies are helping us kind of engage differently with star figures from that.
Yeah.
Thirdly, and this is not research-based at all, I am just a big fan of the films. One of the first meetings I kind of had with my now husband, we talked about Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark at length as a perfect film. I mentioned it in my wedding speech, you know, that kind of thing. Oh. So I will kind of, you know, and I am a really, they were an important series of films for me growing up in the 80s and 90s. Harrison Ford is an important figure, kind of tracing through that. So I'm really happy to kind of talk about the big picture too. Sure.
Should we start there as a means of kind of warming us all up before we get into issues of sort of star cat power and image discourse and all this sort of stuff? Let's start with, you know, how successful we think the film is as a either a closer or an epilogue or whatever it is of the franchise. What did you make of it? What did you think of it? Where does it fit?
So I saw this in the cinema, and I don't get to go to the cinema very often. And the two big films that I have got to the cinema most recently are, you know, showing my kind of age, are the last Star Wars films and Dial of Destiny. So it was important to me to kind of see it, I think, in that context, in an IMAX context. I have to say, given what the critical reception has been around it and the commercial, it's just come out this week, it's been a commercial flop, basically. It's lost huge amounts of money. It was an empty cinema around it. So, that, you know, there is that sense of who is this for and kind of around it. However, on the start of the film, where we kind of get the kind of familiar iconography of the Indiana Jones series, from the typeface to the credits to the music to kind of the people kind of within the frame. The opening of this film, the first 25 minutes, felt to me as a fan really lovely. Mm. Really lovely. Yeah. And I enjoyed it as that moment of this is giving me something of the earlier films. So we'll talk about kind of perhaps the de-aging in more detail kind of around
that.
Oh,
we will.
But it felt very comfortable to me. It was a really kind of a sense of kind of coming home, a bit like that. And I talk a lot about Harrison Ford as the kind of the Uber legacy star, building on this kind of branded nostalgia that Disney particularly, who've kind of produced the film, wants to kind of harness. And I think fundamentally that certainly the very opening sequence, the first 5 minutes, does that for a fan. It kind of gives us the sense of that we are back in 1985, Temple of Doom, or something like that. And as a fan, I comfortably went with it.
Mm. Yeah.
And I think perhaps other audiences, other types of audience, don't make that transition as comfortably as I perhaps did.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna. This is me pretending I know loads about Star Wars and Indiana Jones when I don't. But it seems like And I guess I'd fold Blade Runner, the new Blade Runner. Yeah. There's a sense in which you mentioned the legacy film and writers that have talked about franchises and the legacy film. Often, whether it's the Rocky films and other franchises of which I have seen none, there's a sense in which the old star passes on the franchise to the young star and they kind of take it over. And in the case of the Creed films, that is kind of creatively as much as the lead role. But it seems like, unlike Star Wars, where Ford is passing the baton of protagonist on, this film kind of doesn't do it. It could easily have done that. And I remember some of the resistance to Kingdom of the Crystal Skull as the film was kind of progressing, people were hoping that Shia LaBeouf wasn't going to be the new, and then obviously the film then plays with that by having Harrison Ford in the final wedding sequence of Crystal Skull snatch his hat back to be like, no, I'm still, and there is, and he does it again in the final shot of this film. So it's a legacy film, but it's one that doesn't kind of use, it does use Harrison Ford in a particular way, but it doesn't use him to get people bums on seats, and then after 20 minutes, spoiler alert, doesn't kill him off, and we're now with the younger brother, son,
which other
uncle.
Films in franchises are doing very much, and with some success and some not success. Yeah. But no, there's, and I think fundamentally for me that Dial of Destiny is a film about Harrison Ford.
Yes,
much more than it is in a way about Indiana Jones. And I think the setup, the scene that you talked about, the very final scene is kind of encapsulating that, and I think the opening of it as well, doing that. Yeah. As well, it's the first really of the series where that opening kind of shot of Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones that we get here, we are really being asked to contemplate Harrison Ford as we know him. Mm. He's not in Indiana Jones's costume, he's disguised as a Nazi, but we are kind of given a relative close-up of his face kind of through this. We're asked to kind of look at him as the spectacle.
Yeah.
To get us into the film. That doesn't really happen so much in the others, you know, but they all have star entrances at various points. Raiders of the Lost Ark, this shadowy figure emerges into the light, costumed in the hat and the jacket and everything, and the theme tune kind of swells, and you go, yes, okay, I'll come along on this adventure.
Yeah. You've seen these films before,
haven't
you?
Yeah. but it's not, you know, Harrison Ford isn't as central as the silhouette, I think, and even in those moments. And it's played with. It's always really interesting across all of the films. How is Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones introduced at any point? Mm. And they kind of shift with it. So something like Last Crusade, 1989, gives us a flashback opening again for 20 minutes again. So this is not unusual, what we're getting. Right. And we get the younger Indiana Jones, but he's played by River Phoenix at that point. And we get a self-sustaining narrative adventure that reveals something about character, and then suddenly we kind of flash forward. And the hat comes down in a shot, River Phoenix's face disappears, it raises up, it is lifted, and it's Harrison Ford. And the theme tune swells, it is Ford as Indiana Jones with all the iconography. What's partly noticeable about Dial of Destiny is that it takes a long time for us to get to that mode of Indiana Jones iconography. Yep. Even in that opening sequence, the hat and the whip are there, but they're inanimate. They're in a bag, they're kind of placed there. They get a little kind of note of music to kind of signal their presence. But it's much, much later before he puts it on. And we get that kind of moment. And what I think is really interesting in this film is that it's not marked in that way that it has been before. It's not a kind of mark of spectacle and finally we're here. Something is kind of here, kind of exciting in this moment. It's just there. We've already had the spectacle. And that has been the younger Harrison Ford kind of that we get. And there was lots of kind of talk about, should we recast? Is this Disney going to recast? What are they going to do with this? And pre-production, lots of discussion around this, because this was a lot of time in the pipeline, Dial of Destiny, waiting for the green light to go. And Ford is very, very clear at those points, talking in interviews, where I am playing him, when I am gone, he is gone.
Yeah.
That's it. A real kind of finality. And I think what probably helped that is the sense of what happened around Star Wars, kind of from The Force Awakens onwards, where he kind of similarly had that kind of legacy moment that worked very, very well. It was very resonant emotionally. Mm-hmm. and also had kind of a finite moment, I guess, to it as well. Of course, what we really interestingly get after that is the release of Solo, A Star Wars Story, with Alden Ehrenreich, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Which kind of did its business and everything, and it was clearly a moment of that recasting.
Yeah.
Is it going to work? What's going to happen? How are people going to feel about it? How does he perform as this iconic character?
Mm.
And I think fundamentally not seen as very successful, whether it's successful, whether it's kind of there or not.
Yeah.
So we've had that experiment of recasting a Harrison Ford iconic role. It didn't work. Enough for Disney to potentially reshape their strategy around the Star Wars films. I've read kind of around the kind of the supposed failure of Solo kind of made them think maybe this isn't the way to go. So suddenly Ford's in a position of power and saying, you can't recast me.
Yeah.
It won't work.
Yeah.
So let's drill into that then, because there are other alternate, you know, I think one of the reasons, Chris, I might be a bit ambivalent about Indiana Jones is that we're both big James Bond fans, and essentially I'm sort of like, what, I don't need the whip, I need the tuxedo and the gun, thank you very much. So, but obviously that is an example of a franchise where the central role is recast again and again and again. There's obviously Doctor Who, but there's also like the Jurassic World, which actually I don't think they're great movies, but they do very well at the box office, right? So they've managed to do that intergenerational exchange much better. Now, obviously, this franchise has one problem in that the title of the character is the franchise, right?
Yeah.
So, but I wondered, you say the first 20 minutes feel like an Indiana Jones movie. It felt, and I would agree with you, I thought, whether I like them or not, the fourth Kingdom of a Christmas, which I didn't hate, but it did feel weird. It felt not like an Indiana Jones movie, and this felt like one. So what does... Is it complete? Is it tied to Ford as a kind of a figure of spectacle, or is there something else that defines Indiana Jones as an Indiana Jones movie that might make it able to be recast, you know?
We can't kind of deny the fact that it has been recast. There's a TV series of the kind of, I think, in the 90s, the young Indiana Jones kind of series around there. You know, River Phoenix is kind of there have been kind of these modes and attempts to kind of do it. It's odd. I mean, the historical kind of mapping that I've done from Raiders of the Lost Ark all the way to Dial of Destiny shows kind of really quite clearly in kind of paratextual material, but also in kind of contract negotiations around and material like that, that Ford wasn't particularly important as an individual to begin with. He was there and he was, you know, significant, but certainly publicity around Raiders of the Lost Ark talks far, far more about George Lucas specifically and Steven Spielberg as these kind of selling points kind of all the way around it. And it's only really with, I would arguably, Crystal Skull 2008 that Harrison Ford really kind of gets to kind of, I guess, ratify his value as a star around that character. I think in a sense of control. There was a lot of development again around Crystal Skull in development for a long time. They wanted to make the fourth film, and reports suggest that Lucas and Spielberg were up for it, but Ford kept saying no. So only at that point does he kind of come into it. And just kind of going back to the final sequence of Dial of Destiny that you talked about, Chris, where that idea of the costuming, the hat and the whip and the kind of iconography there of Indiana Jones as something that could be passed on, something that could be de-individualised.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a really lovely shot in Raiders of the Lost Ark where you just get the silhouette of Harrison Ford standing in the desert and he's just, you know, the hat and the kind of silhouette of Jones. You know, we should be able to replace this. We should just be a man in a hat, basically.
Yeah.
And I think what is going on at the end of Dial of Destiny is that kind of embodiment of Ford's own statement saying, this isn't going to go further than this. We get this kind of iris in as a very final statement. The hat is just lying there, passive, I think, on a washing line in New York, you know, there for the taking. It kind of mythically, it should be kind of saying, this could go further. And it's a very, much more so than Crystal Skull's final moment, playing with Ford playing around with the hat. It's a very deliberate, violent gesture of pulling back and controlling that hat and kind of going, not mine. Not for you.
Yeah.
And an action, a firm, if you like, a firm hand kind of going, mine.
Yeah.
I'm still there while I can. So I think that, I mean, who knows really what's going to happen. in terms of the films. I think the fact that it's been seen as a flop probably will stop it.
Yeah.
And will continue that as a kind of a Ford, Harrison Ford only kind of moment around it.
Well, I had a question. Yeah. As somebody who, I mean, my knowledge of Harrison Ford and Clint Eastwood are not great. I've not watched many. I'm now going through a cycle of watching kind of Harrison Ford action movies of the 70s. So I just wondered, in terms of your, like, Ford, it seems interesting. We talked actually about kind of more recent work that he's doing on television in two shows. I can't remember the name of one of them, but the other one is Shrinking.
He's in one of the Yellowstone.
Yeah. And Shrinking has a lot of fun with his aged body. But I don't know much about his career trajectory in terms of particular moments in his career when he was that kind of star, when he moved towards those kinds of movies. Yeah. Was he a genre star? I've basically seen What Lies Beneath and Air Force One. That's it, really. And so I'm just kind of interested in a person who is central to two huge franchises, who seems to work across different genres, loosely speaking.
I mean, we could add in three franchises because he's the first Jack Ryan. Really,
he is the first Jack Ryan.
Well, not the first Jack Ryan. He's the one who kind of brings Jack Ryan.
Who isn't Ben Affleck?
Into a multiverse kind of picture
as well. Yes. So, why is he interesting then as somebody who does all these different things? Because I guess I'm thinking of scholarship on aging and the idea of and scholarship on aging that has looked at Clint Eastwood and Robert Redford and that distinction between Donna Peabody says that it's kind of the distinction between rotting and ripening masculinity. You either age and grunt and you're Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino, or you sort of ripen and you're Robert Redford, and you're the last film I think he did was when he was a kind of like a bank robber, like a smooth bank robber. I can't remember the name of the film.
The Mule or something like that.
I don't know. I can't remember. So there's a kind of weird, I don't know. Oh no, that's Clint Eastwood. But that kind of rickety versus ripening. And what I found interesting about this film and that you have to hold both of those contradictory identities at the same time, because he's old and crusty and hangs his washing up on a washing line indoors and tells his neighbours to turn the music down. But he's also, of course, he's an action star and hangs at the back of a car and a tuk-tuk or whatever. So I thought it was really interesting that it was holding almost these contradictory things together that seemed perfectly embodied by Harrison Ford, actually. That he can do both of those things kind of simultaneously and within one movie.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. It's... we've kind of talked about this, and it's certainly been identified as one of the issues about the de-age sequence is as soon as that figure starts to move, it becomes not Harrison Ford, because he's very distinctive as much as anything else, and clearly he was, I think, 79 when he filmed it. He's, you know, he isn't doing that. At certain points, he's certainly not moving along a train. He'll be kind of doing other things like punches and stuff like that. I mean, it's an odd one with Ford. I think to some degree we forget a little bit in that kind of ripening, kind of rottening kind of metaphor.
Yeah.
He was always a bit older as a star.
Yeah, yeah.
From it, you know, he didn't become a star until about 40, really. And even in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the one that really kind of cements this idea of Harrison Ford as a star figure, as a valuable figure, he's still kind of a bit stiff, a little bit old, a bit kind of crotchety, certainly, and kind of all that way. And
he's an academic.
Yeah, right. Yes. But also believably.
Yeah,
academic as well, as well as the kind of the almost swashbuckling.
Particularly in this film, where none of his students are actually listening to him, as opposed to the first film, where they're hanging on his every word.
It'll be in the final exam. Fine, I'll spoon feed it to you.
Maybe that's why I like Dial of Destiny, because I really kind of quite
so yeah. But he believably, you said, so I hadn't realised that he was born in 42. So that means. Yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark would be 40. Yeah. So I didn't realise he was a kind of aged, he was 40.
Yeah. I mean, even when you look back at Star Wars, he's always kind of the older figure kind of in it.
So that raises the question then, in a film in a franchise like Indiana Jones, if we're saying that Dial of Destiny, you know, the uncanniness is okay, the de-aging is quite good, I think, but the uncanniness comes from the tension between the youth and face. And a body that doesn't move like we know Harrison Ford has historically moved.
Yeah.
It makes me think that in all of the other movies, you have stunt people like Vic Armstrong, and Sir Harrison Ford has often not been. If he was an older star at kind of 40 and Raiders of the Lost Ark's made in 81, there are probably loads of sequences in all of the Indiana Jones movies where it's not Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford is one of five or six.
Yeah.
So actually the technology is only really sharpening this issue of kind of stunt performers anyway, like the idea that this technology is, well, he's too old now to do it, so we've got this younger body in. Well, it seems like he was always too old to do some of these stunts anyway. He's one of a number of Indiana Joneses in this franchise.
Yes,
and some are technology and some are not.
And it's always interesting because the stunt work was a huge kind of promotional point of the first couple of films, certainly. And Lucas always conceived of whoever they cast as Indiana Jones as a kind of a stunt performer who could act, and Ford was on the list just as a type. It'll be somebody like him, that kind of sense. So the stunts, the idea of physicality, I think, has always been really important. And Ford, let's face it, is very physical and very fit, even at 79. And we can talk about, look at the kind of frail body that we get in.
But that seems a performance as so he's old, but that the oldness of him seems. You're right. He is physically fit for somebody who's.
Yes, he is. He's 79 at that point, and that's another spectacle of it. Yeah. I think that why this film is really about Harrison Ford more than anything else. You know, we get the second spectacle of the actual aged Ford body, kind of in his first sequence in the kind of the. Was it 1969?
Yeah.
He's, you know, he doesn't have a shirt on and he's in boxers, I think. You know,
yeah.
There aren't many that would kind of lend themselves, I think, to kind of that visual spectacle. And again, we're asked to kind of contemplate it, I think, kind of around it. What does it mean? And of course, thematically, it fits in with what the film is about. The film is about time and shifts between past and present, with the kind of the mechanism that drives the plot, as with all of, let's face it, the Indiana Jones films, there is a kind of mythical object that is searched for, and we've got the Antikythera mechanism here. You know, the idea of shifting kind of back and forward in time is kind of just inbuilt into it.
But it's also the second that the eponymous dial is the second of the mythical things, because the first one, this lance that's revealed in the opening, is revealed to be, quote, it's a fake and a reproduction. And I thought, well, this whole sequence is about fakery and about replication. Mm. I thought in the spirit of this podcast, always talking about things that are about animation, I was like, oh, this is a really interesting 20-minute... And we've had conversation. Remember when I was first thinking about digital de-aging and the distinction between invisible digital beauty effects and then these self-reflexive sequences that are, we are now back in time, look at what we can do with a computer. So this is a long 20-25-minute sequence of a digitally de-aged Harrison Ford and Mads Mikkelsen. But it seems to also be a response to a kind of anticipation of, well, people aren't going to like this, or there's going to be a question around fakery. And it seems to be one of the first, maybe Captain Marvel is similar in the way that it's playing with time and stuff, but this felt like a really interesting, to start with the film's MacGuffin that is like the real MacGuffin of the film that's never really talked about again, this lance that's revealed to be a fake. And I thought all of this stuff around, we're witnessing history, yesterday belongs to us, Dr. Jones, all this, it seemed to be a kind of commentary on, maybe that's too simplistic a reading, but it seemed interesting that it was setting up something that then it disregards in quite a playful fashion.
There's also the kind of issue of fakery to disguise deeper fakery, or you will know more about this than I. Both of you will know more about this, but there's always this question of who gets de-aged, right? And you said Mads Mikkelsen is de-aged. I'm sure he is, but there's something very different in the register of de-aging with Mads Mikkelsen. I mean, the one thing, just the practicality of it. I mean, he's, how old's the guy? The guy's like late 50s now, is he? 60, early 60s? Mads Mikkelsen now. I'm assuming he's not de-aged. 58 in the current thing. So that would make him, according to the timeline of this movie, what, late 20s when it's supposed to be? Yeah. He certainly doesn't look in his late 20s.
He was born in 1965,
You know, he's kind of got that, he's got the more kind of Hollywood age slipperiness, where really what they've done is dyed his hair and shot him in a but it looks like that anyway.
But he also embodies at that moment more of Hollywood's kind of slippageness of kind of European identities and interchangeabilities kind of around that. So he's not a fixed point.
No, you're quite
really
right,
in any regard.
Yes,
I think
he's now done it all, hasn't he? Yeah. He's probably, has he played a Russian? He's definitely played a Nazi now. He's played Hannibal. He was in the last Harry Potter.
Yeah, he's in the Marvel Universe, the Star Wars films.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, you're quite right, Ian. So we have that as well. So there's something odd about the registers we're asked to see these two characters, because we're not being asked to see the spectacle of Mads Mikkelsen de-aged in the same way are Harrison Ford. And then the other thing we don't have, which I guess is something of a mission. So am I criticising the movie for not doing something? I guess I am. I was convinced throughout this entire movie, because I knew Karen, see this is where the fans
Karen
are.
Allen.
Karen Allen. I knew she was in it.
Yes.
But once we got a time-travelling plot, I got, right, okay, we're going back to Raiders, we're going to see Raiders again, Karen Allen's going to be de-aged.
Women don't get de-aged, Alex.
But women do not get de-aged unless you're Sean Young in...
Blade Runner.
Which, because you don't really get de-aged, you just get fixed.
Well, it's not even her, it's her face on someone else's body.
That's not the point of it. She doesn't get de-aged.
Yeah, fine, yeah.
She gets literally replaced.
So I don't know. What have we got to say about who gets de-aged and who doesn't in this movie? Yeah.
Well, I say in the context of the franchise, it makes, to me, again, kind of... again, perhaps this is kind of more of the kind of like, yes, it's a fine film, it's okay.
I liked it. I'm with it.
I can see its flaws. All of the Indiana Jones films have flaws. They are not perfect films in any regard, kind of around it. But we've already had that story of connecting with Marion, the Karen Allen character, in Crystal Skull. That's the key point of kind of performative tension and the enjoyment of the tension between the relationships we've got there. And she's fantastic in it. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I think that does really work about Crystal Skull. And there's an enjoyment again of, oh, it's just good to see them spar. So it made sense to not do that again in this film. Mm-hmm. And she appears at the end as a moment of kind of closure. Again, a moment of closure. And it's also interesting, I guess, to some degree, in the last two films, how Marion... and Karen Allen has also become a fixed point of, I guess, legitimacy and authenticity around the film. She is an integral part of the story in a way that, you know, the two films in the middle don't make anything off.
Yeah.
But I think, as far as I can tell, I'm sure I read something that said that she's you know, wearing a grey wig. If this isn't her at this point, she is kind of aged up, I think, kind of to look frail and kind of frailer and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I think there's still an element... of change going on there, and an untruth, if you like, around it. But
I mean, the gender stuff is something that is definitely omitted from my sidelined. I would say I tried to bring it in into the stuff I've written on de-aging. But again, we talked about this sort of who gets to be de-aged. There are sort of gender and kind of racial politics connected to this. I would say in terms of gender, women, there's one or two digitally de-aged. So I would say Sean Young, but isn't really de-aged in the same way. It's not her pro-filmic that is being sort of amended. Same with
Princess Leia technique.
It's Carrie Fisher's, it's Billy Lord being kind of, I think it's Ingrid Valor's body with the DH Carrie Fisher on top or something like this. And then there's Michelle Pfeiffer in the Ant-Man sequel, and I think that is digital de-aging. I think she is kind of pro-filmic and is being sort of, but that I'm struggling. I think there's another one in that terrible Ryan Reynolds film, which one? The time traveling, the Adam Project. I think there's a female, Catherine Keener. Catherine Keener is digitally de-aged, but mostly it's 1980s, so you know, Stallone, Pacino, De Niro, Kurt Russell, Michael Douglas. Like there's a grouping of, and then there are people that may or may not be de-aged. Such we haven't got time to talk about Tom Cruise, but people like Tom Cruise and Hugh Jackman who may or may not be being tweaked in post-production in certain kinds of things. Mostly it's a particular image of white masculinity and people like Drew Ayers have written about the kind of transactional nature of white masculinity, that it kind of shows the interchangeability, and certainly with online deepfakes and the way in which certain faces are swapped. Often it's white faces for white faces. Very rarely do people kind of swap across gender or racial lines. It's about the sort of a transactional masculinity between... We could just easily put Christian Bale's face or Tom Cruise's face on this other. Like we could swap them quite easily because you know, there's a certain degree of sameness to the way that, that Hollywood treats its white male stars.
I think as well is in that as soon as you kind of put particularly a female identities into the kind of the face swapping stuff, I think the question of exploitation immediately shoots to the top. Mm-hmm. How are they being exploited? What's the point of this? Because on the whole, why are men doing it to them? There's quite a clip that I showed my students of a real-time kind of rendering face swap on a live streaming broadcast of a, you could see the kind of the streamer suddenly on camera become Margot Robbie. His face is literally kind of being spliced, reskinned with Margot Robbie kind of on it. And it's kind of convincing in that kind of element. And suddenly you kind of go, ugh. And the deepfake porn stuff. It's all that kind of idea of... It raises questions of control, agency, responsibility, all of those things. Whereas a lot of the discourse, particularly that Dial of Destiny was used for, was to talk really about kind of the responsibility of this. This is a benign process of digital transformation that somebody, i.e. Ford, consents to and is kind of very in control of. And a lot of the discourse talked around the legitimacy of using the kind of the real historical image of Ford in Temple of Doom and Raiders of the Lost Ark that was then used in ILM's kind of FaceFinder AI program to kind of sort through and find it. And there's multiple quotes of that you can find of Ford in interviews at the time going, that's real, it's my face, it's me, it's not a digital composite. And there's also a sense that the discussions around this film, because there were so much discussions about this de-age sequence.
Yeah.
There is other stuff to talk about in the film, but we never do. But it was a sense of, you know, we are moving away from the kind of the inauthentic digital image of CGI computer, kind of what do they call it, kind of modelling.
No,
this is a kind of an AI created version of me. It's not quite accurate in terms of it, but in terms of if you just listen to kind of the journalistic discourse around it, you'd think it was generative AI being used wholly to create the new real Harrison Ford. And I think that's why we get that first shot of his face kind of so tight. We are asked to look at how realism has shifted. This is something we know.
So are we saying, before we leave the aging behind and return to it in the spirit of the time travel film, so are we saying then that the sort of the repeated use of male stars as testing grounds for this kind of technology versus female stars who are either, one, not allowed to get old in and of themselves, two, are then not de-aged, you know, we're not going to see a digitally de-aged Helen Mirren or Judi Dench or Meryl Streep, one of the three that are untouchable. And actually, when we do see younger versions of female stars, they are often just lookalikes or the daughter of Kim Basinger. I did wonder whether the sort of 11, 12-year-old Phoebe Waller-Bridge was some kind of relative, some kind of distant, because there was a kind of similarity there. So are we saying that that sort of, the repeated use of white masculinity as a sort of testing ground means, invites a consideration of kind of trust and authentication, that if it was a female star, the rhetoric would shift and it would be more about exploitation and more, it would be more about how is the one doesn't ask of Harrison Ford, how did you feel being poked and prodded by all of these computers? And like that, men don't have those questions asked of them.
And also particularly Harrison Ford, because his public persona is so kind of gruff and sour and in a fun way that he'd tell us. It's that idea that he speaks, he would, you know, tell it like it is, if you like, kind of around that. So he's quite a safe person to be doing this with, because, you know, if it's something kind of that would be kind of exploitative, we'd hear about it.
So those discourses of trust don't quite, they sit well with figures like Ford, and but they don't sit as well or aren't even present in the way that the discourse around Sean Young, as we said earlier, is that her face, she was used as an image and she wasn't even allowed to play a younger version of herself. She was kind of abstracted from the process. She was kind of positioned as a below the line like stunt worker who we don't really know. We don't really know who they are. So that I think is interesting, that kind of register. And again, something that the discourse around the panic around deepfakes and de-aging is now moved on to the extent that we can unpack some of the gnarliness, I think, of de-aging technology and how it's used in particular ways, and how in this film it's set up as a kind of spectacle, because Harrison Ford is heard before he is seen, because he even has the bag over his head. So there's lots of processes of veiling that's going on, I think.
Interesting. Shall we move on and talk about the rest of the movie?
We can.
If we must.
Yeah, we can.
Yeah. Okay, so where should we go next? Should we talk about Phoebe Waller-Bridge? You mentioned her just a second ago. Thoughts? I'm not sold on Phoebe Waller-Bridge, but I think there's something very interesting that she's now been in two franchise vehicles, both of which have the shadow and indeed the presence of Harrison Ford surrounding all of them. And she was also the robot, wasn't she, in Solo, Star Wars story. Yeah. So it seems like the go-to, what do we need to do to inject an old Harrison Ford vehicle with life and vitality? Let's get Phoebe Waller-Bridge in.
Yeah. So I guess a question, as somebody who doesn't know the franchise as well, is she taking on a role that is familiar in those films?
No, since she's the token, or what's happening? There's always a sidekick.
Is there always one?
There's a young boy, isn't there? Across
the first trilogy, the kind of the one in the 80s, there's always a love interest for Harrison Ford. That's the kind of main female role in it. But not always kind of the primary relationship, I think, kind of from it. So in Temple of Doom, you've also got Short Round, the kind of the young character. That's a really kind of lifeblood of that film as well. You've clearly, Last Crusade is much more about his relationship with Sean Connery as his father than it is about the kind of particular love interest in the film. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, by the time you get to Crystal Skull, Marion's back, and it's that kind of element.
But we also have Mutt.
And we have Mutt. So there are three
out of the five Indiana Jones films are about generations and aging and stuff. So Last Crusade, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and Dial of Destiny. Yeah. So this film feels more typical.
There's a lot about it, it's continuous.
I hadn't put that together. I thought, this is the film where they're doing aging now because he's 79 or whatever. And I, again, reading some of the pre-release material, thinking about the aging narrative wasn't Mangold, who's also done Logan, of course, a film about aging kind of superheroism. Like there's a way in which the aging narrative wasn't quite done as well as it should have been in Crystal Skull. So this is kind of doing it properly. Yeah, it seems like the last three of these movies have
I
been
think
about
with
this.
Crystal Skull, it's certainly to begin with, because the beginnings of these films are always important about positioning where the character thinks he is at any point. You know, how kind of stable he is. That was about him being kind of out of his time. Even in the 50s.
Yes.
Lots of my back and all that stuff. And which we don't really get. No. We get a lot of sitting down chases. But I think what's also interesting in just thinking about kind of Ford again as just a presence illuminating, really, I think, kind of how the last film unfolds. You know, there's quite a sequence where he rides a horse kind of through New York, kind of from it, and you think, oh, come on. And, you know, obviously at various points that his head is superimposed onto kind of...
Yeah, even I can see that.
And it's really clumsy at certain points as well. But it's also odd because Ford, certainly in the 80s, was constructed as this kind of Montana figure living on a ranch with horses kind of through that. And he's in the kind of, we said, the Yellowstone prequels. Him on a horse, even at 79, isn't unbelievable. He can do it. He's capable of it. He will be riding there at some point. It's not a total fabrication, although at certain points, obviously, it is kind of through there. There were lots of publicity shots of him on the horse, because I think they were filming that in... They were filming it somewhere in the UK.
I think it's Scotland, Glasgow.
So that was a really kind of image that circulated, the kind of the odd virility of the ageing kind of Harrison Ford come through that. So I think it's less about being out of one's time that Crystal Skull is, but is very much a dialogue between past and present. Because what it interests me, again, about the opening sequence is it's a flashback. It's meant to be the past. However, in the context of all the Indiana Jones franchise, it marks the present. It's a 40-year-old Harrison Ford fighting the Nazis. That is what we assume is the present contemporaneous of Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
So Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
I think... I couldn't get her character is slippery in a way that I can't quite figure out her, because sometimes she's the antagonist, sometimes she's the duplicitous sort of sorry and locks the gate behind her and runs away.
Sometimes
and then other times
she's trauma filled, sometimes she's wisecracking.
Seem to have no beef whatsoever when they're going da 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 in the cave, or they're having these really quite intimate moments between kind of goddaughter and godfather. So I was she's really slippery, and maybe that's where the film, and it doesn't matter who plays the role, I think her character type is particularly ambivalent and a little bit kind of chaotic in a way that isn't sort of grounded.
I think that's also linked to this status that she has to have as kind of goddaughter. You know, not anything really tangible kind of from it, because how else do you explain it?
And doesn't she say, what is a goddaughter, or what is a goddaughter anyway, or what is a... And that really...
But she's also really... Like, there's this, you know, line about, you know, when my father died, if only there was someone predestined to take over in case my father... Like, she's quite... They make a big deal about the goddaughter thing in a way that I don't think I understand the cultural significance of. I mean, the main reason being that they've sort of tried the son angle and they weren't going to put Shia LaBeouf in it again, so...
And they've tried the dad angle as well.
They can't really go on there. There's also a long lost daughter. Right.
And she obviously...
It has to work through that contrivance, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then she is the... I'm going to quickly look up. The sort of... The little boy.
Yeah.
She's Teddy. Yeah, she's sort of... I can't remember how the film sets up their relationship. She's also caught between two different roles. She, you know, this father figure, let's say, who is also in it. Like, more films should have Toby Jones in, and for longer. But that's a separate issue. That she's caught between two different roles. So yeah, I don't know. I think
what is interesting about her casting and her performance as kind of Phoebe Waller-Bridge there is that she's got a very kind of quite distinct and I think for this moment unique sense of timelessness. You see her in the kind of costumes of the 70s, and absolutely appropriate running around the streets of New York. Mm-hmm. But then in the Tangiers kind of sequence, she's dressed in very kind of 40s-esque kind of clothing as well, and she looks absolutely fine there. I know it's not the 40s, but it may as well be that kind of sense of it. And I think that's important, again, in terms of the slippage between past and present that the film is trying to negotiate, that you get somebody who can belong comfortably in a lot of different eras and through that. And I think her performance, it's clearly that kind of wisecracking, kind of almost screwball kind of heroine type of character that Marion was. I mean, she is very much harking back to kind of what Marion is in that first film, much more than the other kind of women in the film. In the franchise sequence. So I think that they're quite canny about that. And well, what do we need here? We need somebody who isn't sexual in the way that we have constructed it in the past. We need somebody who can kind of belong to comfortably in the Indiana Jones kind of world from the 40s to the 70s virtually. And also not be too defined as a particular type of kind of character relationship. She's got to be able to kind of move between that. I mean, yeah, that could also be a flaw.
I think Fleabag is incredible. I don't think Hollywood's quite worked out what to do with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and I'm not sure this film quite knows what to do
somebody
with it.
And it might have been Ford has said this of her, that she could be a star if she wants to be.
Yeah.
That sense of, and also I think that sense of kind of control and power that is really important to her character in the film, that you can see as we've been talking, is clearly representative of how she is seen behind the scenes, you know, the hand on the Bond script, that kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah.
This is not mere performer, if you like.
I think the film isn't quite sure whether she's short round, if she's the wide cracking sidekick main to kind of bring a bit of life and mirth to the thing, or whether there's real dramatic heft in this kind of goddaughter sequence.
And I don't think there is dramatic heft.
No, I don't think there is either.
And I think that's potentially one of the issues with the film, is that there's never anything at stake in that relationship in a way that there is certainly with Henry Jones Sr., Sean Connery in Last Crusade. You know, there's something very... And, you know, the idea of the son in Crystal Skull and reconnecting with Marion. There's something very kind of clearly at stake in all those moments.
And the bit where you find out Mutt's fate is quite affecting, you know, like despite not having much affection to that character from the film, but the way Ford delivers it and the kind of the reconciliation with him and Marion is like, you know, that works. Okay.
I had a question actually about the diminished stakes of this kind of goddaughter relationship. Do you think that the diminished stakes of it are to do with the film's negotiation of time? Because there's a lot of this happened then, flashback, then it's how we are now, then that happened then, and then we're in the 50s, 51, and then there's another bit, and then we go back even further. Yeah. And so all of the time hopping doesn't allow enough time for there to be meaningful sequences. Yes. So I don't know, structurally.
I think that is true, because one of the things that's potentially a different here as well is that the supporting cast don't quite get their moments.
Yeah.
I think that we expect, and we've got, like you say, Toby Jones is here.
Banderas.
You know, and he gets his scenes and everything, but it's not quite the same as what, let's say, Denham Elliott gets across a couple of films. Or even Ray Winston, or John Hurt, or somebody like that. And then we've got Antonio Banderas as the captain that takes them to the underwater adventure. And I was, and it took me a minute to go, that is Banderas, isn't it? What's he doing here? And why isn't he doing more? Really?
Didn't he describe his role as almost or like not quite a cameo? It's sort, and then he gets second billing or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it doesn't quite not know what to do with its people.
Mapping that onto the various time frames also kind of highlights this kind of fragmented nature, right? We've got Toby Jones only exists with a de-aged Harrison Ford, so we never get.
He's a character of the past.
He's a character only of the past. Antonio Banderas only in the present, at least according to this movie. Then we've got the Mads Mikkelsen, same with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Mads Mikkelsen and Harrison Ford liminally between the two worlds, but you've got the weird link between Phoebe Waller-Bridge and Toby Jones is, and like they're kind of there together, but they're not together. The way stardom is dispersed throughout the various time zones also adds to this fragmentation.
But actually, I think the key thing is when Antonio Banderas is killed and Phoebe Waller-Bridge finds the whole thing superb and wonderful and is laughing, and Harrison Ford's like, no, I've just lost one of my dearest friends, and that's the issue, is that it doesn't quite know the stakes of one relationship versus the lack of stakes, and characters not aware of the stakes of relationships.
Yes.
Maybe that's it.
There is that kind of odd bubble that she's in. I mean, if we talk about it in the terms of that as well, we've got the return of John Rhys-Davies.
Yep.
Salah.
Of course, yeah.
Obligatory bomb reference.
Yeah. And again, it's something that I understand completely why it's there. I particularly like it, actually, the inclusion of it as a way of thinking about just the scope and scale of the Indiana Jones kind of universe, I guess, in terms of time, from the 30s really kind of onwards. And the idea that a character in Raiders of the Lost Ark becomes an American immigrant. You know, the idea that what was kind of the world of the Nazis is now the world of kind of hope and prosperity having an American friend allows for. And I think that's a really interesting inclusion into the film. I don't necessarily particularly like the scene. I think it's quite clumsy. And I think as time goes on, the casting, particularly of John Rhys-Davies in the role as an Egyptian, becomes more and more problematic.
Sure.
Particularly when he talks, he kind of goes, "Give him hell, Jones," and because he's Welsh anyway.
Sure.
Jonesy, you know, it's so kind of there. And I don't think. I think that there's nice elements to it, but I don't think that quite works either.
Yeah.
So I think for me, the some of the flaws of the film are very much in not really knowing how to treat the supporting cast. I think that's a wider problem in how ensemble films are developing in Hollywood. You know, there's a long, long history of even star-driven films, but that have kind of the time for character actors. And knows what their value is and what they should be doing within the space of 2 5-minute sequences. They're still present here because it's still part of the franchise and we expect that kind of structure. But I think fundamentally, right in terms of writing and kind of, I guess, editing and directing, we're not really, the filmmakers, more broadly perhaps, don't really know what to do with these characters anymore to make them anything other than present. They don't become more than that.
Yeah, I felt that way. I was just looking her up there. I felt that way about the CIA agent, Agent Mason.
Yes, yeah.
I felt that way about her. And the sort of the way in which the film signals the kind of bad Nazis, where I think Mads Mikkelsen's asking the kind of the bellhop, where is he from originally?
Yes,
and these kind of little clumsy bits where I was like, well, I'm not quite sure how that's worked. So I agree. I think that the film doesn't quite know what to do with its supporting cast and... But I quite like the henchmen. I thought they were quite cool. But I thought Agent Mason, I didn't. That sort of, as a black female in that world, I felt the film could have done a bit more with her.
Particularly where we're in 1969, a black FBI agent in 1969 you've got to do something more interesting than kind of that, right?
to shoot her on a plane, yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know what... Yeah, exactly. Either you lean into the tension or you kind of make a joke. I don't know what you do with it, but that's...
But you do something.
You do something with it, yeah. With it, and that's quite a sort of, yeah, vacuous role, really, isn't it? Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
These ciphers are there. You know, Salah becomes just cipher of immigration. She is clearly a cipher of, you know, potential change, but not quite there yet. They're not really given. And I think that elements of that is kind of, you've got to trust the performer to do something with these as well, even if they're kind of underwritten. Mm. So
yes,
which you do get, I think, much more in the other films.
Yes. Okay. So that's we're skipping through the film nimbly here, but we get the kind of the adventure. We get the map, of course.
With the map with the.
Even I love the map. Even I.
But hasn't I probably said this before? Hasn't in Victor Perkins's. Stuff on fictional worlds, where is the world? He talks about, you know, you don't need to show an event in a fictional world to know that it's kind of happened.
Sure.
And he talks about animated maps and the dotting and stuff, and it's like, that's enough to, I don't look at that and go, well, that journey never happened. Like, it's a sort of, he mentions, I think, so when that map came up, I wrote, animation used to show the journey. Perkins, that's all I have to say about that.
It's a weird thing, the map, though, isn't
it? That's all I have to say.
It's so fun and exciting.
Yeah.
Even though it's just silly.
It's John Williams.
It is also partly the kind of score. I have talked far too much, I guess, about Harrison Ford as a kind of, like, it's about him. I mean, Williams is still there. He is still very much a kind of clearly important presence to these films. And the power of the music.
Well, given that this is the first film to not be directed by Spielberg, these kinds of continuous authors become really important. So... Ford, yes.
Because it's also Williams' last score, I think, as well.
Oh, really? Because he's 90.
So. Yeah. I assumed he didn't do it, actually.
So no, he. So that's the sort of...
And he also went, that's it, I'm done.
Oh, so, right.
Yeah.
So there you go. So it's ageing. So actually, that's interesting, that it's the ageing of Harrison Ford, but it's also, you know, it's Lucas who's now pretty much sort of only...
And he's not involved at all.
No. So it's a sort of... And if Williams is this is his last one, it's sort of... It's the world of Indiana Jones. It's the people that are involved, the creatives that have sort of given. The legacy narratives are as much theirs as they are Harrison Ford's.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you said at the start, Sarah, that this is a film about Harrison Ford, and it's a film about kind of, in some way, The Last Jedi was a bit like this, about kind of thinking about one's relationship to nostalgia, to the past, to time. Yeah,
and I think that's why I quite like it.
Yes.
You know, and certainly those moments, I was, like I said earlier, I was very happy to be in the presence of Harrison Ford as I remember him, kind of those moments. So it becomes about me and the audience that is happy to kind of make that leap, I think, as well, and not all are. Certainly.
So what did you make of the kind of final act then? Because that's probably where I thought, oh, right, you haven't gone where I convinced myself we were going back to Raid, we were going to do like iconic, we're going to do a Back to the Future.
I knew you were going to say that, yeah. He's looking at himself.
the boulder goes that way this time, I don't know, something naff like that. And so I'm pleased they didn't do that.
Yeah.
I wasn't expecting them to suddenly end up in Troy, though,
you
know, both the film and the mythology. Right, so that sequence, we can talk about that. We've talked on the podcast before about kind of, you know, armies and the spectacle of armies feeling like a very not that felt very post to that felt very post Lord of the Rings, post Gladiator. There was something about the spectacle of that
so
post noughties in a way that the other bits did not.
So that's what they've gone back to. They've not gone back to what is it, 218 AD or 219. They've gone to 2004.
Grand Pitt's somewhere.
They've gone back to 2004. Masses and multitudes.
I mean, I guess at one level, it is to situate Indiana Jones as a mythical construct. You know,
that
it belongs there.
Yeah.
That it is part
the fantasy
of
board.
Kind of,
oh,
yeah.
On board. Okay, right.
That he belongs. And at the point where he kind of has the conversation, I want to stay here. This is
that's
where I belong.
Odd, yeah.
And at some point, you do think, I think he's going to do it. And of course, you know, in terms of the characterization, he was going to do it. He has to be literally kind of dragged out of that space. And the sense of the I guess that it is a character of the past now.
Yes.
That this is the end. He will. He has no future. He only exists as the past. But he exists as the mythical kind of structures. An artifact that the entire series has been investigating and trying to kind of claim. claim for a museum all the time, kind of that kind of sense of it, to preserve, I guess.
He disappears into his own sense of history.
Yeah. Okay. So I understand it as a statement, I think, from that respect.
What is the statement then? Because the fact that he doesn't...
isn't allowed to.
Let's do some clunky metaphors.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford is Indiana Jones. Indiana Jones is a character desperate to stay in the past where he feels he belongs, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge rips him out of it against his will and puts him back in the present day. There's a certain kind of are we the audience Phoebe Waller-Bridge in this scenario? It's like, you know, just let me be in the past. Why are you dragging me back out? And the fact that the film celebrates that he doesn't. Isn't left behind forever, and he's given a kind of more quiet but more contemporary ending. I don't know what it's trying to, you know, for a film that, you know, it's that classic paradox. It's a film that seems to be saying, careful about jumping and losing yourself in
but
the
look
past,
at the de-aging.
But look at all this. And it feels like the old movie.
But it's that spectacle and celebration. I think fundamentally it wants to be a celebratory film as its final statement, and to not kind of have a heroic, tragically heroic death.
Sure.
And you know what? I will go with that kind of happily. I don't want Indiana Jones, Ford, lost in time. In that way, I think, you know, there is a kind of, I think, an emphatic kind of enjoyment in saying Marion's back, kind of, that kind of thing. It's trite. I mean, and it's a small scale, you know, going back to why do we always end up with kind of romantic relationships as the kind of the be all and end all of success kind of through that. So it's repeating all of those tropes. But I think, I think it wants to set up the idea of kind of the character, the world, the performer as these kind of mythic statuses, but to not be tragic in its final statement. I think, again, to still give Ford and therefore Jones a moment of power and control and kind of success.
Interesting. I agree. I as somebody who's not that, as I said, not that familiar with the franchise, I really enjoyed the film, and I thought it was, and I hate this phrase, but it was a fitting end, because I thought, it's using the aging not once but twice, and we talked about this as well, like this kind of second sequence where they're sort of playing a little bit with time. Yes, the film is about time, the narrative is about time, but it's also this kind of interesting reflection on aging stardom and aging bodies and people who are stars and people who have to give up their stardom. I don't know, there was something, I like the idea that you said that he sort of belongs, he's a kind of mythical artifact. We've now put him in a box and you can wheel him and stick him next to the Ark of the Covenant and we move on. So he's
but I think that's it, isn't it? It would be that kind of ending if he was left in the ancient past. Sure. You know, the ending of Raiders of the Lost Ark is where we see that vast, because I kind of slightly disagree that we don't see scope and scale in these films. We do, you know, we see kind of, you know, rallies in Berlin in Last Crusade. We see the scope of that warehouse where the Ark of the Covenant is. I mean, that's always a very disquieting ending for it.
So is this a film about, yes, it's about time and so forth, but is it also about like the curation of the past and a kind of historiographical, this is how stories are told, and this is how the past can work in relation to the present.
And visualise the past in terms of the de-aging technique, right?
And we can recover the past.
Yes, and I think that's it. We recover Harrison Ford's face, basically, and because there's another metaphor that kind of runs through it, where he's given the kind of the cheap brass clock for his retirement gift, given that the Antikythera mechanism resembles a clock and kind of works on that kind of mechanism, a wrong clock and a right clock, basically, as artifacts.
Yeah.
One that kind of is mythical and allows you...
Yeah, because that's how the film opened, that sound of ticking, a ticking clock, and then you hear his definitely not de-aged voice, and then you see his de-aged face. Yes, no, I did like it. Yeah, I did like it. I think the film, has its... But it's...
And I think as well, it's important to kind of think about, you know, across the kind of whole franchise, is that... On the whole, we experience these films fragmentedly. I don't know about you, but I tend to watch them on TV when they're on.
Yeah.
Bits of it, my one scene might catch you. Obviously
I watched it too. I watched it over two nights on an iPad from Disney Plus. Thank you very much.
Kind of so
just the Spielberg intended.
You know, these have always been quite fragmented films, and they show them out of order. So we always kind of are negotiating that past and present and what Ford looks like or what the others look like at any particular.
Yeah, which
moment.
One is this now? Interesting.
Where does he belong here?
Yeah,
what's kind of going on?
Yeah.
Is that franchises generally then as well? Like this this kind of time. A lot of de-aging are in franchise movies. The X-Men movies, the Marvel movies, famously. But these kinds of, I don't know, franchises seem a welcome home for these kinds of Terminators, where time travel narratives. Yeah. And it seems like, yeah, franchises, because you don't often, if you're me, certainly you don't watch them in the right order. Mm. They're already playing with our conceptions of time and so forth. So actually, this is just almost a film about, it's about so many things, but it's about like how people have probably engaged with this franchise. A bit then, a bit recently.
Yeah. And if you caught the opening sequence at the wrong time, you know, switching it on, okay, not at all moments, but there would be a moment where you would think, and I think this is what it wants us to do, definitely. Which one am I watching? I can't quite figure it out.
There's a paradox, a temporal paradox in all of these kind of IP franchises, right? Which is that the story has to continually move as fast forward as possible while staying still, right? Nothing can happen because we want a franchise to be at the end of this, so we can't really, you know, we can't kill off characters, we've got to keep all our options open, and we want to create a situation where we can just do another one of these afterwards, but we've got to make it as exciting as possible and do as many things in it whilst we do nothing.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of, I don't mean this a kind of as a criticism, so there's a weird temporal paradox of, you know, Bond movies have been doing the same thing again and again and again since 1962, and then once we do something different and everyone loses their mind, you know, same is true here, same is true of Marvel. Time is a problem.
Yeah.
Yes, well, time is a problem on that note.
that was beautifully done.
I have one final note, which is that very opening scene of the movie looks very like the Disney stunt show of Indiana Jones in Hollywood Studios in Orlando. I don't actually know if it's still there or not.
I
don't know if that is a deliberate thing or not. That always looked a bit like Raiders and a bit like Last Crusade and a bit like.
But I think that's
like
well,
that.
You know, they do kind of converge into kind of one, and it becomes quite difficult to kind of pick them apart thing around it. But on another final note, just in terms of the very opening of it, it's the one bit that I do think is a shame as a fan.
Can I say the Paramount thing?
The Paramount logo, where it doesn't fade into a version of that Paramount logo.
The molehill.
I feel it really is a loss of a marker of something.
That sounds like the gun barrel, the version.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. Yeah, and
really
to see the Disney castle is fine, but there is a kind of sense of... And I think that kind of shows how long this film has been kind of going on, that when you design kind of stuff like that in the past, the idea of having to kind of plan for who might own the IP at any point, and if you build in a kind of a joke basically like that, a reference like that, how sustainable is it through this? But that's something that does still, I feel the loss of that, I think.
Yeah, they probably would have probably been tempted to do it, right? But then they probably, you know,
popped it at the end or something. I see.
Any final notes from you, Chris?
No, I think the voice, I did have a thing about the voice in terms of, the aging. We've spoken a lot about the images, but I think the soundscape, so Williams is score, and the gruff voice of Harrison Ford, I thought was kind of quite interesting. I don't really have anything other than that, and I thought the train tunnel sequence was identical to Skyfall and Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning.
How many Bond references have we put? Let's see.
There's a. Of course, he's running on the top of the train. Of course, there's going to be a tunnel. Of course, they're going to have to. But it's interesting, you know, because of the Mission Impossible film and that film's rejection of digital. Well, that film's rejection of explicit digital de-aging, I would say, versus. Okay. Some stuff that's definitely gone on. So I guess what I like about the film is how it seems to encapsulate a lot of what it encapsulates a lot about what is quite complex about the stars overlap with technology in 2024, I would say.
I mean, just again on that sequence, I think it's indicative of some of the other stuff we talked about around characterization, is even that train sequence, because of the way it's filmed and composited together, there's still nothing ever at stake on that, because you never really believe that they're on a train and that they might fall off or something like that, because it's so kind of stable.
If it wasn't within a DH sequence, would it feel different? Because you already know it's artificial.
No, I think they just stand wrong.
Oh,
I think they kind of for it. To me, it totally... is much more uncanny and de-immersing than Harrison Ford's face and voice for me at that moment. That's where I really kind of go... I've had enough of this,
yeah.
this bit. But I think maybe that's one of the things about the film, is it's so invested in its own mythology, it forgets really to kind of say, really, there are minor things at stake here that really matter, and that's what really we invest in a kind of story world.
Interesting.
Right, great. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for talking through Indy 5 with us. You have a book coming out, or is it out already?
We're working on an edited collection at the moment on Stars and Franchises.
Okay. Any thoughts on Harrison Ford appearing in that? Or,
he won't appear in that because he's in the Indiana Jones collection, which is where I talk much more about the history and legacy of Ford in Indiana Jones, and I think that's coming out. I think next year with Manchester University.
The Stardom is coming out next year, or the Indiana Jones?
The Indiana Jones collection. The Stardom book will be, Stardom and Franchises will probably be 2026.
Well, okay. Listeners in 2026, go out and buy it now. What a temporally confusing podcast this has been. But absolutely. Okay, well, terrific. Well, look forward to both those publications coming out and seeing your thoughts formalised in print. Great. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yes, thank you.
It's been brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, no, right. So, have we got any Indiana Jones stuff online?
No, we haven't. So I'm now thinking about Dial of Destiny.
Fancy-animation.org. Click on the Contact Us tab. Chris would love to hear your suggestions for blog posts in the future. You can listen to the archive of podcasts wherever you get your podcasts, but you can also find it on fancy-animation.org. We're at FanAnimResearch on various social media outputs. And that's been us for another week.
Bye.